This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington, and here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We had an option whether we turn them away and say, okay, you are now full, we can't take anybody, then turn the ambulances away, or just activate and treat patients. Yes, it's not that dignified, it's not ideal, but did we save lives? Certainly.
That was Matabo Matibula, the CEO of South Africa's Steve Biko Academic Hospital, on ways to cope with the overflow of COVID-19 patients. Details coming up. Also, refugees living in Uganda's capital fear violence during and after the country's election. And Ethiopia claims Sudanese forces are pushing forward into a contested region. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Ugandans head to the polls Thursday to cast ballots for the country's next president. Musician turned politician Bobby Wine is the most prominent of 11 candidates challenging President Yoweri Museveni, who has led the country for nearly 35 years. Halima Tumani talks to analysts about the significance of the election and what is at stake.
Stability, security, and peace have been President Museveni's key selling points to Ugandan voters, with the campaign themed Secure Your Future. Bobby Wine, on the other hand, has directed his campaign at young voters, promising freedom from Museveni's heavy-handed rule and pledging to create 5 million jobs should he assume power. Saira Birete, a pro-democracy political activist, says for many Ugandans, these elections are not about economic issues, but about redeeming the soul of the nation.
If you see Ugandans coming on the streets, they are simply saying they are tired of people that have hijacked the state. We have rising levels of impunity by duty bearers. This is an example of things that have made citizens of this country angry and hungry for change. So it's not about issues that this candidate is speaking well. No. Can we have our country back? Then we shall redefine how we will be governed.
Political analyst Morrison Rakakamba believes many Ugandans, especially the elderly and women, still see Museveni as the commander-in-chief who will ensure peace and stability.
In this crowd of presidential contenders, Bobby Wine has the charisma. He has more star power, especially because of his music to galvanize young people. But there is nothing new that, in my view, that he's saying. But at the national level, President Museveni remains much more stronger, especially because of the constituents of the Ugandans who have had experience before of instability.
Ordinary Ugandans such as Ibrahim Walugembe agree that while Wine is appealing to them, they still would like a peaceful and stable country. Walugembe says the person who has talked about issues that affect him has been the president, His Excellency. Walugembe adds that even if the old man has been able to achieve much, he should retire so Uganda can get a new leader, because it's been such a long time. With a population of close to 42 million, about 70% are young Ugandans struggling to survive, motorcyclist Tamale Juma says he believes Wine is the only leader who will deliver the peace they desire. Tamale says, we don't have any peace in this country, and that because we are so poor, we work under a lot of hardships with no medicine in hospitals. The education standard is so low. He also says the poverty level is high, and because of that, people would like to see a new leader. Tamale says Museveni has failed for the 35 years he has been in power, adding, we want to see if Bobby Wine will bring us better development. About 17.6 million Ugandans are eligible to vote in Thursday's election. Polling begins Thursday at 6 a.m. local time, ending at 4 p.m. According to the Electoral Commission, all 134 districts in Uganda have received polling materials. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
U.S. Ambassador Natalie Brown said the U.S. has canceled its decision to observe the election, saying it had no choice after the East African country's Electoral Commission failed to accredit 75 of its observers, according to VOA's Swahili service report today. Only the East African Community team will be observing the voting. The election follows a bloody campaign that also included a shutdown of social media platforms using VPN yesterday, with the numbers of Ugandans being blocked growing today. The action came after Facebook deleted pages of pro-government elements, accusing their operators of violating their content dissemination policies. Refugees living in Uganda's capital have asked security personnel to provide them with security, fearing violence during and after the elections. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The violent, chaotic presidential campaign has left many dead and scores injured, fueling fear for refugees living in Uganda's urban centers. Those in Kampala say they're not sure if they want to stay in the country. Eyob Kasepe, an Eritrean refugee, says he and others are receiving threats from some political groups.
As a community, as refugees in total, we don't support, you know, the either parties. You know, what we are expecting is just peaceful transition, peaceful election. But, you know, as we hear from, you know, the societies here, some Ugandans tell us that, you know, if one of the parties is elected, they tell us that, you know, they are going to chase us as refugees out from this country.
Kasepe has called for beefed up security in the areas housing refugees.
It's well known that most Eritreans, you know, live together. Not only Eritreans, you know, the refugees are total in at the whole. It's well known that, you know, we live together in the same building or in the same parish. So we don't live, you know, in this subsidy area. So if it would be better if the government allocated, you know, security personnel, you know, to preserve the, you know, the peace of the refugees.
John Kasole, another refugee in Kampala, has called for peace in Uganda, saying violence reminds them of the situations they fled back home.
Because we came here for a peace and we had it already, but if it's a condition, there is a violence inclusive, so we can have a challenge as we, as the refugees, we can have challenges because we can even remember what we went through for some years back. And
Julius Muchunguzi is a communication officer in Uganda's Office of the Prime Minister, which is responsible for refugees. He assures refugees of total security even after the general elections.
The security provided by the competent security agencies of the country that is being provided to Ugandans during these elections in Kampala, in other urban areas and across the country will be the same security that is extended to our brothers and sisters who are in the country as refugees are fleeing for safety and security.
Muchunguzi has asked the refugees to report threats so the perpetrators can be arrested.
And so those that are threatening anybody are involving in criminality, and criminality is dealt with according to the law. So Uganda is here, the refugees are here, the agencies of the state that are responsible for keeping law and order are here, and I would advise that those cases where people have been picked out and threatened because they are refugees or even nationals, that those cases should be reported to police.
Muchunguzi cautioned the refugees against getting involved in the elections or participating in any violence related to the polls. Uganda has about 100,000 refugees living in Kampala and its suburbs. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
South Africa's Gauteng province is bracing for a seemingly devastating second wave of COVID-19, with the capital Pretoria now identified as the epicenter of the pandemic. The government says the province's hospitals are being overwhelmed and the situation is nearing a boiling point. One specialist facility, Steve Biko Academic Hospital, has set up tents in the parking lot to help cope with overwhelming numbers of patients with complications. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
With more than 50,000 current cases, the rapid rise of COVID in popular Gauteng province is worrying. The daily average of new cases, driven by the new variant of the coronavirus, has already surpassed 6,531, which was the highest figure during the first wave. Like many other medical facilities across the country, the Steve Biko Academic Hospital is battling to cope. It has resorted to erecting tents in the parking lot for arriving patients, some of whom require oxygen and other specialized attention. Matabo Matebula is the CEO of the hospital.
We had an option whether we turn them away and say, okay, they are now full, we can't take anybody. We can turn the ambulances away or just activate and treat patients. Yes, it's not that dignified, it's not ideal, but did we save lives? Certainly. People were saved, the people that would have otherwise died.
Other public hospitals are getting hit hard across the province, with the number of COVID-19 admissions tripling to more than 2,000. Clement Marule, a member of NEHAU, a union representing health workers, says their infection rate has left most of them traumatized and afraid to go to work.
The situation is really gradually getting out of hand. You can imagine if in a hospital like Jokes Mukhari, 83 almost of healthcare workers positive, and in Chris Hani Baragwanath, in one ward, 19 of these healthcare workers reported positive. It's a situation that you can't take lightly.
Lawrence Konyana, Deputy President of the National Funeral Directors Association, says funeral parlors are barely coping.
It's been quite a lot of strain, especially with the coffin shortages in certain areas. It does mean that, you know, some of those can't really bear with them, but you might have to wait a bit longer. Why are you doing that today? Your fridges also are getting full.
Although Gauteng Premier David Makura says the situation isn't out of control yet, he admits the second wave is moving faster than they had planned.
The new variant makes the second wave infections to be much, much higher. And I can tell you we are going to continue to revise these plans. Plans are made, but they must be adaptable. And plans must be adjusted as the situation evolves.
The province expects to buy over 300 more critical beds and add others to its field hospitals set up specifically for COVID-19 patients. Over 1.2 million people have been infected by the coronavirus in South Africa, with more than 34,000 deaths. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Ethiopia yesterday claimed Sudanese forces were pushing further into a contested border region when five Sudanese women and a child were killed a day earlier. According to the French news agency AFP, Sudan has strongly condemned what it called brutal aggression and the targeting of defenseless civilians. The two Horn of Africa nations have long feuded over the fertile Al-Faska region. Ethiopian Foreign Ministry spokesman Dina Mufti told reporters the Sudanese force moving into Ethiopia's hinterland should return to the previous status quo. Both sides are saying they do not want to start a war. The border tensions comes at a time when Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt are also trying to resolve a three-way row over Ethiopia's Grand Renaissance Dam. David Schenker, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, says the U.S. is committed to deepening the relationship with Morocco, which has been a strategic partner in achieving stability in the region. The U.S. Embassy in Rabat called Schenker's recent trip to Morocco a historic visit, as he is the first U.S. official to visit the Western Sahara. Elizabeth Myers, an American political analyst living in Morocco, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about U.S.-Moroccan relations and U.S. policy regarding Western Sahara.
The U.S. relationship with Morocco already runs very deep for a couple of hundred years, as a matter of fact, going all the way back to 1777, when Morocco was the first country to recognize U.S. independence, entered into a treaty to provide our ships safe harbor there. Since then, that relationship has maintained very strong ties. The U.S. has had military bases there for decades in Kenitra, in a small town just north of the capital of Rabat. There's been decades and decades of intelligence sharing, and Morocco certainly is a key ally for the U.S. on combating religious extremism in the MENA region. Another very close tie is the 2006 free trade agreement between Morocco and the U.S. I believe it's the only Arab country with a free trade agreement so far. So while saying deepening of relations is definitely a good thing, it's hard to see how they could be much more deepened given already the close relationship. And certainly the incoming Biden administration, Biden himself has had a close relationship with Morocco. In 2014, for example, I was in Marrakesh for the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, and I remember vividly President-elect Biden's speech at the time, opening the opening ceremony. It happened to be his birthday. He was, while most of the audience were Moroccan, he was met with great warmth, and I think that his knowledge of the country and his feeling toward the country are both significantly positive.
The U.S. Embassy in Rabat called the trip by Shenker a historic visit, as he is the first U.S. official to visit the Western Sahara. How significant is such visit to the Western Sahara following President Trump's recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over the region?
That visit is very significant, not in and of itself, but as a measure of the recognition that the Trump administration has given to Morocco's claim for sovereignty over the Western Sahara territory. It is a reversal, actually, of 30 years of American policy on this issue. And it is completely contrary to the UN position on the territory, which is that of occupation or colonization of the territory. But what is also surprising is that this recognition occurs during an armed engagement that basically ended a 29-year-old ceasefire. And it's extremely significant because it is likely to precipitate more violence in the region. In fact, the Polisario, which is backed by Algeria, which doesn't recognize Morocco's claim, has committed to engaging in additional warfare. And this is also a backtracking of America's support for Morocco's autonomy plan, which the U.S. has stated in a number of scenarios, including before the UN, was serious, credible, and realistic, that provided the framework for further negotiations for this territory. Because what you're dealing with is the Sahrawi people who live there are claiming, as the U.S. did in 1777, independence. And this is a situation that needs to be resolved by negotiation involving all of the relevant parties, and not by universal declarations and recognitions of situations that are bound to increase the violence and lessen the prospects for peace.
Morocco joined the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan in agreeing to normalize ties with Israel under U.S. brokered deals. What was the Moroccan public opinion reaction to that move?
Morocco is a very complicated country in terms of its ethnic and religious diversity and how people have reacted as a result of that to the announcement of normalization with Israel. Actually, a partial normalization, but the relationship has existed for decades. When in the 50s, there were many Moroccan Jews who moved to Israel, and the roots of the now more than 1 million citizens of Moroccan origin go deep with Morocco. There are even 10 ministers in the Knesset who are of Moroccan origin. And the Moroccan population there is the second largest after the Jews of Russian origin. But in terms of Moroccan public opinion in general, it is difficult to gauge because foreign policy is in the sole realm of the monarchy. And so any criticism of the monarchy, including foreign policy decisions like this, can be problematic for a citizen. And in Morocco itself, the normalization part of this equation, this quid pro quo, has been downplayed significantly. So a number of of people have suggested that this quid pro quo transaction is simply not necessary and is actually a bitter pill to swallow.
That was Elizabeth Myers, an American political analyst living in Morocco, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Rights groups in Cameroon doubt the military's claim it will properly investigate the latest alleged massacre of civilians by its troops. Activists and witnesses say the military killed 10 villagers Sunday, including women and children, while attempting to fight separatists. Cameroon's military denies it was responsible, a line that has been questioned in past cases, as Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
37-year-old teacher Jacob Mendy says he fled Cameroon's southwestern village of Mautu after witnessing the military on Sunday shooting civilians. He spoke via a messaging application from the coastal town of Limbe.
Cameroon military invaded the village of Mautu. They were shooting indiscriminately. The international community and the world, United Nations, African Union, they are killing our people in cold blood. They invaded Mautu. They invaded our villages. Kill our young guys. These are civilians. The world should see.
Activists and witnesses quoted in local media say troops killed 10 villagers, including women and children. Cameroon's military on Monday acknowledged clashes at Mautu village, but said reports that troops killed civilians were unfounded. In a press release, a military spokesman accused Anglophone rebels of a massacre and trying to blame the military. The statement by Army Captain Cyril Serge Atongfak Gemo said troops surprised a group of armed men in the village, killing some while others fled. It gave no casualty figures and said a military investigation was ordered to uncover every detail. But Cameroon activists poured doubt on the military conducting a proper investigation of yet another alleged massacre by its own troops. Felix Agbobala is a human rights lawyer and founder of the Center for Human Rights and Democracy in Africa.
There is a need for a fact-finding mission, a commission of inquiry, to ascertain whether all the victims were civilians, and if they were civilians who were not taking any active part in hostility in the conflict, then the military is supposed to be held accountable for the indiscriminate shooting and killing of civilians.
In December, three Cameroon soldiers were charged with killing villagers, including women and children, while fighting rebels last year in the northwestern village of Ngarbu. Human Rights Watch says troops were responsible for the deaths of 21 civilians, including 13 children and a pregnant woman. Separately, seven troops are on military trial in Yaoundé for the killing of two women and two children. Cameroon's government and military initially dismissed all the allegations of troops killing civilians as efforts to tarnish their image. But under international pressure and from rights groups, authorities later prosecuted the troops. Anglophone rebels have been fighting since 2017 to form an English-speaking state within the French-speaking majority country. Rights groups say both the military and rebels have committed atrocities during the conflict, which the UN says have left over 3,000 people dead and more than 500,000 displaced. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Armed groups have made a move to seize the Central African Republic's capital. However, early today, in a post on Facebook urging citizens to remain calm, Prime Minister Fermin Ngrabada wrote that the attackers, who came in large numbers to take Bangui, have been vigorously pushed back. According to a Reuters report, the assault on Bangui represents a marked escalation in fighting with rebel groups that erupted around a disputed December 27th election. The armed groups started attacking towns close to Bangui about a month ago. A Reuters witness heard explosions and later saw helicopters circling over the city. The gold and diamond-rich country of 4.7 million has been hit by violence since former President François Bozizé was arrested by a rebellion in 2013. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.